Happy Tuesday and welcome to another episode of the Locked On Red Sox podcast. I am your host, Nessun's Lauren Campbell. I will be joined shortly by my co-host, Massachusetts Pirates team reporter, Jake Iggy. As always, thank you for making Locked On Red Sox your first listen of every single day. We are so excited for this episode. We are interviewing 2004 World Series champion and former Boston Red Sox pitcher, Bronson Arroyo. We have a lot to talk about. Of course, we have to touch on the infamous A-Rod slapping the ball out of his glove and the ensuing fight that Alex Rodriguez had with Jason Varitek while Bronson Arroyo was on the mound. This is all just part one of our conversation, and we are so excited to share it with you. So let's get right to it.
You are Locked On Red Sox, your daily Boston Red Sox podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
We are here with 2004 World Series champion and former Boston Red Sox pitcher, Bronson Arroyo. Bronson, thank you so much for joining us today. How was your new year, your holiday, and everything in between?
It's been good. Yeah, just I was actually down in the Keys. I was from Key West growing up. A lot of people don't know that because I moved to a different place in Florida when I was 10. And, you know, all your high school stats and all that stuff come from your high school. But my parents were from the Keys on both sides of my family. And so I'd redone my grandparents' place over the last 3 years. And so my family was down in the Keys for Christmas for the first time. So it was like 72 degrees. It was nice.
Oh my God. That's awesome.
You just made me have a flashback. My grandparents are from the Keys. And I remember like a few years back, I had a hose and it went into a manatee's mouth. And I thought it was like the coolest thing. It's crazy that you can do that stuff down there in the Keys.
Yeah, I never really lived up north, so I'm just learning about being, you know, I'm in northern Kentucky right by Cincinnati, and I'm trying to, you know, things like winterizing your pool or, you know, your sprinkler system. I had no idea, so I'm just, you know, I'm learning a different environment as I go.
It's a whole new world up in the New England Northeast. It's whole totally different.
Right. Yeah, in Beantown, I didn't have to worry about anything, though. You're living in a building, you know, there's no grass right. To take care of, there's no pool, so... I didn't get the experience when I was playing for the Red Sox.
And so you said growing up in the Keys and your family being from the Keys, were you a fan of Florida baseball teams growing up, or did you have an allegiance somewhere else?
Well, there wasn't any baseball in Florida at the time, so it felt like everybody was a Braves fan, you know, because the Rays and the Marlins hadn't come along yet. So you were either, it seemed like everybody was a Dolphin fan in South Florida, and then all a Braves fan. I happened to be a Cardinals fan only because when I was 5 or 6, I was getting into playing T-ball, and I had seen Ozzie Smith do a backflip, I think on a Saturday game on TV or something. And I looked in my glove, and inside the glove, it was Ozzie's signature. It was like, you know, his model of glove, whatever they were selling at the Kmart or whatever it was at the time. So, you know, he became my favorite player. And so I watched some Cardinals games, you know, in spring training, they would be around the St. Pete, Clearwater area. So I got to see a little bit of that, but most of the time, you know, back then you only had 5 or 6 channels. I wasn't seeing much baseball on TV really.
And the Braves were always on TV, no matter what, like they were just the team that was always on.
Right. Yeah. It was either the Cubs, right? You got WGN at your house maybe, and you got TBS. So it was like, yep. Those two teams were easy to be fans of.
That's funny. And we'll get in more to you playing with the Red Sox in 2004 and 2003 as well. But you bring up that you were a Cardinals fan growing up. I mean, what was that sort of reaction when you found out that you were going to be going against the Cardinals in the 2004 World Series?
Yeah, you know, it was weird because at the time, you know, I come from the National League. I was in Pittsburgh for 8 years. You know, a large part of that was in the minor leagues with the Pirates when, you know, nobody knows who you are. And playing in Pittsburgh, we were losing 90 to 100 games a year, so you weren't being exposed on a national level for the most part. And so by the time I got in a Red Sox uniform in 03 and started realizing how different it was to play in the American League East, to play in Yankee Stadium, to be on ESPN every time you played, you know, it felt like a different world. And I got trapped inside of that world for a few years there. And so by the time 04 comes and we finally get over the hump and beat the Yankees, I don't even really know who's on the other side. Like, we're not paying attention to the National League. I don't really know who's on the Cardinals staff. You know what I mean? It's right. Like, it was almost like an afterthought. In a way, it felt so insurmountable to get through the American League side of baseball and get to the World Series that you never thought about it until we were faced with it. So, but it wind up being that, you know, it felt very familiar to me just because I'd seen those uniforms for such a long time and been such a fan of Ozzy all those years. And then being with the Reds after that, having to go head to head against the Cardinals in the same division for a long time made it, you know, that much more special.
Definitely. And the 2004 Red Sox team, they were certainly special. You guys called yourselves the idiots. There was so much personality. There were so many big personalities alone. So many memorable moments, particularly one with you and Alex Rodriguez. Alex Rodriguez running down the line and slaps the ball out of your glove. And you could tell in real time, anyone watching has no idea what happens. It's kind of like, did they like collide? Did you drop the ball? But you could tell instantly, as soon as the camera went to your face, that something was wrong and that you were not in the wrong at all. Can you just take us through that moment? Like, what was going through your mind? Did A-Rod say anything? Like, what was going on? The umpires? It was just a ridiculous situation.
Yeah, I've talked about it a few times. And, you know, I've actually never met Alex other than the fact playing against him. I played against him in high school. He was he was on the best team in the country out of Miami Westminster in 1993, and I was a sophomore. And I was playing on the varsity, and we played against each other at our ballpark, and he hit a home run in extra innings to beat us 4-3 back in 1993. But, you know, that play it was a slow breaking ball that I threw, and, you know, Alex was known for, you know, having a little bit of a hole in the inner half and being able to drive the ball to right center, right? He loved to hit behind the fastball, and which made him right on the breaking ball all the time. So instead of throwing him like a 75-mile-an-hour breaking ball, I threw him a slow one, like 68, and he caught it right off the end of the bat. You know, there's a lot of adrenaline going on in those types of games, and that can make you a little jumpy. And so he hit it right off the end of the bat, which created the ball spinning like a top on the ground. And I knew that if I didn't get a good handle on the ball, it could just shoot out of my glove. And so the first thing I was really concentrating on was like making sure I got the ball. And by the time I did that, I really took my time and I looked up to see if Doug Minkiewicz was on first base. He was standing right next to me. And in that moment, there was like a smidgen of a panic because you're thinking that I won't be able to get this out here and then I'm really in trouble. And so when I looked up though, Alex was jogging. He wasn't running hard really. And so it was just kind of a relaxed tag. I was just kind of like, oh, you know, let me just tag him and I'll see Jeter at second base and make sure he doesn't go to third. And, you know, we'll continue and see if we can get this last out. And, you know, he just hit my arm. And like you said, it was so fast. Nobody my glove flew off behind him and I caught it on the other side of him. And I didn't know that he kicked the ball all the way down the line. I didn't know how the ball got down there. And so Minkiewicz had a better observation of what was going on. You know, he was actually, when I was down on the ground, he was asking me if I was okay, because I guess he thought he hit my arm pretty hard. But, you know, after that, it was a tense situation because the crowd was starting to get really riled up. You know, you could feel the New York crowd getting irritated in a way if they thought the call was going to go against them. And I remember Orlando Cabrera was arguing with these guys by the dugout the whole time, too. And he was talking to them and making hand gestures to them. And I was close to second base, kind of talking to the middle infielders and stuff. And Alex was trying to explain to the umpires how that was just his regular run. And so, but what was funny is that I was watching him say that and I was kind of laughing, and I guess he was on my face, and he said, I could read his lips, and he said to the umpires, you see, he's laughing at you guys because you're getting the call wrong. And so,
oh my God.
But you know, it was one of those moments. I mean, you know, it didn't matter how long you had ever played the game, whether you were as seasoned as he was, or if you were relatively young in the major league level, like I was. I mean, it was just a really big moment to be a part of, and something you couldn't really control. Just luckily it went our way and it gave me a little bit of breathing room because it sent Derek back to first base and didn't have him in scoring position. So I could really focus on trying to get Gary Sheffield out without having that runner in scoring position.
We hope you are enjoying our conversation with World Series champion Bronson Arroyo. We will get you right back to our conversation in our second segment of Locked On Red Sox. As always, thank you for making Locked On Red Sox your first listen of every single day. But I want to tell you about Built Bar. You know me by now. You know how much I absolutely love Built Bar. And now that it's the new year, that means some New Year's resolutions are starting to kick in. And if yours is about getting fit, maybe eating a little bit healthier, make sure you include Built Bar in your plan. Built Bar is the best protein bar that tastes like a candy bar, doesn't have that chalkiness, maybe that cardboard taste that some other protein bars have. And it makes it easy to stick to your resolution because it tastes so good, you will want to eat it, unlike those other protein bars, like I said, that can be a little chalky, a little cardboardy, maybe even a little waxy. It's just not good. Built Bar is not like that at all. There are so many flavors to choose from. There's raspberry, double chocolate, mint chocolate, and my favorite, cookies and cream. And Built Bars are covered in 100% real chocolate. So by like week three of your resolution, when eating healthy is getting a little bit tricky, you're kind of thinking, where's the chocolate? Built Bar. Built Bar is where the chocolate is at. And we have an offer for you. Go to built.com, use offer code LOCKED15 for 15% off your order. That's LOCKED15 for 15% off at built.com.
It's so funny hearing you describe it because when you watch the video, you just see Alex and he's like, what are you talking about? And exactly. He's like, it's my running motion. Like there's no way that I hit the ball. And then when you see the slow-mo, it's the little slap right there. And anytime I watch that video, all I do is just get that anger of, and just say expletives of F the Yankees, F Alex. And, you know, obviously what he does now, you know, for Fox and everything else, you know, I have respect for him. But anytime I see that video, it just brings the Yankee hate out of me.
Right. I think, yeah. You know, it's funny. I've never gotten to sit down and have a conversation with him. I don't know if he'd want to have a conversation at all. I mean, what he does on TV, I've had a lot of people say that he's, you know, they've grown to really enjoy, you know, his perspective of the game and what he brings to the table. And you can see more of a personality. You know, I always thought Alex got a little bit of a bad rap because I think he was such a superstar at such a young age. He had a little bit of what I observe is the Tiger Woods syndrome a little bit, where they're always trying to say and do the right thing perfectly and never really just, that's what was easy for me. It's because I wasn't a superstar. I could just drop my guard and be who I was in the locker room and talk to the media as if I'm talking to, you know, one of my friends. Where those guys had to be real particular about the way they said things, and you just felt like you were getting a bit of a fake, a bit of a fraud, a bit of a not getting that real person's personality. And I think you're getting to see that from Alex now on TV, which is pretty cool.
Definitely. I think when you get out of that athlete mode and that, I don't want to call it a robot mode, but you want to give off this persona, and to see him completely different throughout the postseason has been almost refreshing as someone who grew up as a Red Sox fan and grew up in that 2003, 2004 team, just like really kind of like shaping my teenage years, and to see him totally different now has been, like I said, a breath of fresh air. A little painful to say that, but after the play with A-Rod kind of slapping the ball out of your glove, things got a little feisty with the Yankees fans and they started throwing stuff onto the field. What was that from your perspective? Like it happens so often in professional sports, but to be on the field when that happens, was it just kind of like a, what the heck is going on?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I think 2003 really got me partially, you know, seasoned to what that rivalry was like. You know, coming from those Pittsburgh days, I can remember the first time I came into Fenway Park, I was walking to the bullpen in 03 and Kevin Millar could see on my face that I was looking around the stadium a little different, you know, and he said something like, you know, we're not in Pittsburgh anymore, princess, or something like that, you know, you know, you realize really quickly. I mean, my first time warming up in the bullpen, I'm in Fenway Park, Pedro's pitching, he looks like he's going to make it through the sixth, and I'm coming in, I thought just for the seventh, it wound up being my only save of my career. I pitched the seventh, eighth, and ninth against the Mariners, and it's my first outing in Fenway Park. I just thrown a perfect game in Pawtucket earlier in the year, and somebody screaming at me, you know, Arroyo, if you don't save this game for Pedro, you won't make it out of the stadium alive. And it's like, and I'm thinking, man, aren't we at home? You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't believe that in Fenway I was hearing that. So, you know, I wasn't prepared for that at the time. But the 03 season, especially how crazy those playoffs were, showed me exactly what that roadmap would look like. And so, you know, getting to 04, being in that stadium when they started throwing the stuff, you know, it was a bit of, you know, it was a little weird. I mean, you had the riot crew out on the lines and it started looking like a war zone a little bit, you know, and you're thinking in ways that you never thought you'd think about in a sporting event, which is, I'm not going to order room service at the hotel because what if they put something poison in it? Or what if they try to make me sick? And we were having our team meetings not inside the clubhouse anymore because we thought George Steinbrenner was always bugging all the locker rooms. So we didn't, we would have our pitching meetings on the bus riding back to the hotel from the stadium. You know, you're doing these crazy things because you're playing at such a high level, but I was enjoying it. And at the time, you know, I had commanded my space enough at the major league level to slow down and enjoy what was going on. I mean, even though those were high leverage, high pressure situations, I had already played, you know, I probably already pitched by that point in my career about 13, 14, 1500 innings professionally. So I was seasoned enough. And I was the type of guy who could handle that type of pressure and kind of, you know, enjoy it at the same time that everything was going on. So it was fun to be in that moment. I knew it probably wouldn't get any bigger than that. And so I was trying to take it all in at the same time that you're trying to compete against these, you know, world-class athletes.
Makes sense. I can't even imagine how, you know, intense it is when it's Red Sox Yankees at Fenway. I mean, obviously at Yankee Stadium, it's intense, but I've been to 10 MLB stadiums and no better atmosphere is better than Fenway Park. So what was the atmosphere sort of like, not only when you pitched against any other team, but also mainly against the arch rival, the New York Yankees?
Yeah, it was just always a buzz. I mean, it always felt like a, you know, I tell people all the time that, you know, there's a difference in pitching in a playoff game or playing in a playoff game compared to any other time during the season. You know, opening day probably feels like a playoff game. There's that buzz in the atmosphere. And then everything else is a notch down from that. But playing in Fenway Park is as close as you could get to playing a playoff game every night. It's still not quite there, but it's about as close as you could get. You know, it's so small. It was so packed in tight. You know, the fans are right on top of you. When the Yankees would come into town, I mean, there was fights in the stands. I mean, it really felt like it was personal, even though I don't think most of the time, you know, the players had any kind of true beef with each other, but it just felt like the dislike was just coming onto the field from the stands, and that you couldn't help being in these situations that felt like something might go awry, a fight might break out, you know, things might get nasty. And you know, when you're playing in a world with guys that are, you know, these are big guys. I mean, I'm like out there 175, 180 pounds, you know, some of these dudes are 245, 250 pounds, they're big guys, you know, so it can be a little scary at times, but you know, Fenway Park brought an atmosphere that made you feel like if you didn't bring your A game, that you wouldn't want to show your face in public. And that is different than a lot of other places. I can remember my friends being in town and saying, "Hey, are we going to dinner tonight?" And I'm like, "Dude, after that performance I just gave, it's like, I'm staying in. You guys want to go eat? Go ahead. But I don't want to walk in the Capitol Grill and have people look at me like I'm the devil because I just got beat by the Yankees. You know what I mean?" Right.
And especially with this, the rivalry, the fans, just everything makes it so special and so electric. Another moment with A-Rod was when you kind of plunked him, and him and Veritek ended up getting into an altercation. Everyone knows some people think that's the moment that kind of broke the 86 year curse. But what was that like, you hitting him and then watching that all unfold just like right in front of your eyes? I mean, you said Fenway was electric. I can't even imagine what it was like that day.
Yeah, that was probably the strangest day of my entire career, because there's something strange going on. So I think we weren't playing really good as a team at the time, and maybe the Yankees were playing better. They had beat us the last few times we played them, and so the field was a little wet. I think they had rained earlier in the day, and our front office had come down to the clubhouse, and they were trying to convince us to call the game. To not play. And Kevin Millar, Ortiz, and I remember there was two or three other guys that went into the office and basically said to Theo and Tito, like, "You guys are crazy. You know, we've got Tanyan Sturts on the mound tonight, and we're going to get a healthy Kevin Brown if we reschedule this thing in September." And we knew how hard it was to beat Kevin if he was healthy. So Kevin was like, "We're playing." Well, in the middle of all that going on, the umpires got control of the game because a certain time period had passed, and they said, "Game on in 30 minutes." They were irritated. So I was sleeping in the weight room because I used to take a nap before the game, and I was taking a nap waiting for them to come back and say game on in an hour, and then I would start getting prepared. And the umpires were irritated, so they said game on in 30 minutes, and I need an hour to get prepared. So this was like the nightmare dream you've had of, you know, whatever it is, you know, going to school and not having any of your supplies or whatever you had as a kid, like these horrible dreams. That felt like that moment. And so I literally was just up, got my uniform on, got in the bullpen and threw like 10 pitches and it was game on. It's like Yankees in Fenway Park and I'm ice cold. And then early on in the game, this fight breaks out. So not only am I already ice cold, you've got all the strangeness going on. This fight breaks out. Your adrenaline is going through the roof. And then you got to go back out there and try to get these guys out. You know, it was a very, very odd day. You know, I think Alex probably thought I intentionally threw inside on him. You know, somebody told me that. But he was a big film guy as well. He liked to watch a lot of film. And I didn't double up inside on righties a lot back then. And I doubled up in there with a sinker. It's like an 87-mile-hour sinker that hit him on his elbow pad, which couldn't have hurt that much. But he was agitated, and, you know, the whole thing unfolded.
I love hearing stories. You've brought up Kevin Millar a couple of times. Just every time someone says something about him, it's just his personality just shines through in stories. And I feel like he's exactly who he is, who we see on TV, and how he just personifies himself. Like, that's the true Kevin Millar.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's some guys that what you see on TV is not exactly who they are. Kevin is dead on what he is. So is David Ortiz. And, you know, when you said earlier about so much personality in that locker room, if you ask, you know, guys in Major League Baseball, you know, from 2005 to 2015, let's say, you know, I would probably be up there as a guy who had like a lot of personality, who played the guitar and threw parties on the team and did a lot of things. But on that Red Sox team, I was like a little kid. There was so much juice in that locker room between Pedro and Derek Lowe. And I mean, the whole locker room was a character, and I was just like observing as like a video camera.
And so what are some of your favorite moments about being around in like that type of clubhouse? I mean, Lauren brought it up earlier, like they were considered the idiots. So right. Having all that personality, having, you know, all that swagger that team had, what was it like being a part of that clubhouse?
Well, Kevin is the one, Millar is the one who made the whole thing unfold, right? And it started in 2003. It started, we came back off the road in August sometime, and Kevin told me to shave his head. And so I shaved his head bald. And then he came in for the next month every day and said, you got to skin it to win it. You got to skin it to win it. He came screaming at everybody, you got to shave your head if we want to win the whole thing. So he convinced everyone on the team to shave their head, except for Nomar and Johnny Damon. And Nomar was getting married in the offseason. And he said, if we won the World Series in 2003, he'd shave his head and send it in a Christmas card. And nobody knew that Johnny was growing his hair down to his shoulders. So those are the only two guys that didn't do it. And so it kind of started. And Kevin was the linchpin to unlocking David Ortiz, Manny Ramirez, and making it okay to be who you were in the locker room and be as crazy as you wanted to be as long as we played the game hard. And so Kevin was the guy who started that. And he was like a, you know, just stirring the pot all the time. And so it'd be about, you know, 6:30 for a 7:15 or a 7:30 game. And Kevin would start taping his wrist at his locker. And then he would just start chirping. And I'd never been around a player who talked to management the way he did. I mean, he would talk to Terry Francona and be screaming at Theo Epstein at the same time. Like, you know, he's talking to them like they're his little kids. And so, you know, he made it okay to do whatever. And then that led to Pedro bringing in like the smallest man in the world from the Dominican for a while in the locker room. And just, you know, having guys like Curtis Laskanik that people don't really know his personality from that team too much, but Curtis was a lunatic too. And Derek Lowe was bouncing around the locker room. And there was days that Pedro was as crazy as it could get in there too. So it was like, you mixed all these guys together and Kevin just kept stirring the pot and made everybody worse. So, you know, it was fun. And I tell you what, it was so impactful inside that locker room that you couldn't resist. You couldn't resist it to the point where when Kirk came over, when Schilling came over, he was known for don't speak to him the day he pitches, right? Even in spring training, talk to me the day I pitch. Him and Randy Johnson had that thing. I'd say by the middle of May, I saw Kirk laughing and playing cards with guys the day he pitched.
Wow.
And that was only because Kevin made it to where, like, you're going to be in this environment and it's going to be kind of a lunatic in here and no one is going to be able to resist it. Like, if you don't like it, tough luck. And, you know, I enjoyed the atmosphere. It was a show before the show every single night to be in that locker room and watch those guys do their thing.
That's so fun. That's another Kevin Millar story where it's just like that personality just shines through just in stories alone. It's amazing to see the role he played on this team in a clubhouse full of big names, the Manny Ramirez, the Curt Schillings, the David Ortizes, and it's Kevin Millar, who's just like, sticks out. And like you said, talking to management the way he does, just crazy, crazy stories about him.
Yeah. And what you see on TV, like now, you know, it's why he's so good at what he does on MLB Net, because he created a shtick for himself in the way that he talked. And that kind of bled off to some other guys of the game that all have kind of been friends over the years. You know, I went to David Ross's retirement party when he finished with the Cubs, and you saw guys like Ryan Dempster were there, and, you know, guys like Paul Bacco, and there's a whole group, and Jake Peavy, there's a bunch of guys who, and Johnny Gomes, they all kind of stole a piece of guys like Kevin Millar's personalities and created their own kind of personality in a way. And those, you know, for the most part, those were really the good guys of the game, because that what they really were trying to do with all of that was bring the team closer together and really make people feel like they were at home. And it was always nice to have a guy like that in the locker room.
We hope you enjoyed part one of our conversation with former Boston Red Sox pitcher and World Series champion Bronson Arroyo. We are so excited to bring you part two on Wednesday, so make sure you check out that. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at lalalalauren, three laws, Lauren with four R's. Follow Jake Iggy at Jake Iggy. And of course, the Locked On Red Sox Twitter account at @LO_Red Sox. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to Locked On Red Sox right here on YouTube, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to subscribe. Don't forget to also check out the other Locked On shows across the network. Locked On A's, Locked On Giants, Locked On Yankees. Everyone does such an incredible job, especially during this lockout. And now that you've made Locked On Red Sox your first listen of the day, head on over to Locked On Bets to make it your second listen. Locked On Bets is your one-stop shop for all of your betting needs. It's hosted by your boy Q with expert analysis and insight from Lee Sterling. It's free and available wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great day. We are so excited to see you Wednesday for part two of our conversation with Bronson Arroyo.